This episode is sponsored by Sanebox, a great way to focus on the important emails and boost your productivity.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets roar back with economics looking better. Employment report rings a positive tone. While the pandemic is ravaging our personal health. Plus, a few listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 669 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Independence Day, the 4th of July. Hey, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I am your host and the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And I think it's going to be kind of a weird year for celebrations. A lot of things are going to be much different around the country, probably different in your house this time of year where we're used to going to beaches, going out, doing our thing, having lots of people over, going out to parties. And down here, in what seems to be now the epicenter of this virus in the United States, I mean, we saw a record number of new cases just this weekend in Florida. And while we're going to be having fireworks that are sponsored by the city, it's a little bit different this year because no one's allowed to actually go and gather at the beaches. No one's actually allowed to gather at the parks where you would usually have the fireworks. The various areas around town are going to do attend to an 18-minute firework display at 9 o'clock on July 4th, but you're not allowed to be in the vicinity. In fact, I received an email that while these shows are going to be going on, people are encouraged to watch from their, quote, backyards, front porches, their balconies, or virtually. So now, Not only do we have all this virtual meetings going on, we have virtual fireworks that we're going to be having this year. So I guess this is what it's come to. It's really a kind of a sad state of affairs for a lot of areas around the country and people in general. It's really, I don't know about you, it's really taken its toll on me in terms of, you know, the inability to really have a normal way of doing things, but we're making the best of it just like you are. I know you are. Hopefully you can enjoy the holiday weekend. Again, considering all the roadblocks and things that are going on. So in terms of this weekend, in terms of where we are, investors pretty much could celebrate. I mean, what a great week for markets that we had, right? We had this incredible snapback from that incredible amount of selling that we saw a few weeks ago, and that followed into last week a bit, but yet markets are finding some comfort in the fact that economic news is looking, I would say, a bit better. It was expected because we were coming off of these low bases, but it was a couple of different things this week that really sparked the fire into investors where we had only a four-day trading week. Because we're seeing these reopenings that are happening and companies are able to do a bit better. There's some better guidance, or at least, well, I shouldn't say the word guidance because that's been pulled. But there's some better commentary that are coming out of a lot of places. I mean, just look at the numbers from FedEx, for example. They beat expectations pretty well. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that could say that if you take a look at what they did compared to what expectations are for what they were going to do, that they didn't blow the top off of that. So FedEx was, you know, it is a good benchmark for global activity. Now, in these times, a little bit different because a lot of the global activity right now is being shipped, more so than ever before. People aren't going out shopping as much. They're not actually going to the store. So therefore, how do they get their goods? Well, it's being shipped to them. So FedEx obviously had something there. However, while they did beat expectations pretty well, they pulled their guidance for the rest of the year. And when you look and did a bit of a deeper dive into the numbers, the current quarter was significantly lower from the same period 1 year ago. A lot, by about 50%. But the stock is only off by about 10% from last year at the same period. So what this means is that investors are still willing to give many companies a pass right now. So it wasn't only the first quarter that was, okay, you know what, we're not sure what's going to happen here. And whatever the number comes in will be better than probably hope it to be. Analysts cut their levels pretty significantly, making a very easy bar for them to vault over. And here we are saying that, you know what, well, maybe we're going to give a pass on next quarter or this quarter's earnings as well, even though companies are pretty much putting up blinders for any of us to see what's actually going on for the rest of the year. And that's, again, reasonable because they don't know what's happening. They don't know exactly what their levels are or what they're going to be seeing over the next 6 to 12 months due to the fact that there is a very uneven global economic situation going on where there are reopenings happening and some are faster than others, but we are also seeing that there is a significant increase in case count and many places in the U.S. are starting to question the reopening. We saw places around the world slowly but surely opening, some saying, you know what, we're going to slow down at this point, but we can go back and forth on this, right? We can look at the economic reality and the earnings outlook and wonder why markets continue to hold up. And I think the big reason that we could all agree upon at this point, and we can realize that, you know, the monetary and fiscal stimulus together, the combination of that has been so incredible, amounting to about 30% of GDP. Think about that. 30% of GDP. What are we talking about? $7 trillion was spent just here in the United States, or at least slated to be spent in the United States on a variety of things, whether it was direct money going out to individuals in the form of stimulus checks, PPP programs, bailouts, quantitative easing, bond buying. You know what I'm talking about. All of this. So if you really think about 30% GDP for a second here, what does that mean? Well, if we had 4 months of zero activity, zero, that 30% of GDP filled that gap. The stimulus filled the void for almost 4 months of activity. So the big question I think right now is going to be, what's next? We have a very significant issue about to happen. And you have to wonder how that's going to play out, where the income cliff is about to be upon us very, very quickly. The income cliff where the $600 per week of additional federal unemployment compensation that's being paid for many people on top of the normal, usual state-based unemployment compensation is going to expire. Slated to expire the final week of July. What are we talking about? 3 to 4 weeks from here, right? What's going to happen at that point? So there's some conversation and talk about, well, we're going to have a $1 trillion Heroes Act that's going to be put forth that is going to at least provide some level of additional aid, whether it's the entire amount or part of that, for the ongoing expansion and extension of unemployment compensation for individuals. However, there's also some opposition to this. The concept that, you know, if they keep on getting and giving out all this money, it really doesn't encourage people to go back to work. And if that's the case, how are we going to get people back to work? It dissuades them from doing so. Now, I'm not going to really fight the merits of this because I don't really know how that's going to work out if, in fact, there are no jobs to go back to. If that's the case. Yeah, we saw a pretty good number. You know, over 4 million people went back to work or were rehired, but that's kind of backward looking. You know, realize that the employment number is from last month. We're continuing to see about 1.5 million people sign up for initial jobless claims of unemployment insurance on a weekly basis. And even though a lot of people were hired back after the reopenings happened, there's a bit of a rollback happening with that. And therefore, some of these people may not be on the payrolls in the next monthly report. Now, there may be some others that come back that offset that, but we have to really be cognizant of the idea that there are a significant amount of, I would say, maybe not a sophisticated way of saying this, but there's some wonky numbers out there. Analysts that have been doing this, and they do this full time, are unable to get even close to what the numbers are. So I can't tell you if we stop providing for the unemployment compensation, if that's going to all of a sudden force people to go back to work, and if that is going to get our jobs numbers back, and if people are going to be earning as much money as they were when they were on unemployment. I mean, some people could be earning as much as $800 to $900 per week when you combine not only the federal unemployment insurance, but also the state. And therefore, that could be on par, at least, with what they were earning before. And if their job is even available to them right now, if they go back to work. So I think there is a really big question right now as to what's going to happen. And the opposition to this particular item is pretty, I think, pretty significant. As we are seeing that, and they look at, well, we added 4 million jobs and industrial production is picking up and looking better. Pending home sales had one of the best months on, well, the best month on record, of course, from a low base. And the stock market is close to all-time highs. Well, that's good. So I think when they start going through this process and trying to figure out what to do, I think they may lean on at least a reduction of the benefits and not giving all of that money, as they have been, into a very long period into the future. There's a dramatic cost to this. Now, whether or not some of the other parts of the bill, like the infrastructure and the money for the states, money for certain health organizations goes through, that's all up in the air right now. But I think the biggest issue right now that we really need to focus on in the next 3 weeks is what is going to happen with this unemployment compensation, because that's a big part of the spending of people right now who don't have jobs, that they have the ability to utilize that as a stopgap, more so than just the small amount of money that they get from unemployment from the state level. So something to consider, something to look at, something we're going to keep a very watchful eye on into the next month or so. So with that, I want to take a look at the quarter. I want to take a look at what sectors did really well for the quarter, what didn't do as well, because it was a pretty substantial quarter. I mean, a real close to a record 3 months of returns on markets. And of course, yes, that's on a V recovery of the markets from the low that we saw and that big sell-off, obviously, that was March 23rd. And then the Fed came in and the fiscal came in and all of the different stimulus came in. And there was this big, incredible amount of a love affair again with the stock market. In fact, when I've talked to TD Ameritrade and Schwab, and I've talked to TradeStation and Interactive Brokers, they're opening up record amount of accounts from first-time investors. That tells you something. People think that the stock market, with all that's gone on and all that is going on, is the place to be. So I want to take a look at some of that and go through it. I think it's pretty interesting. I'm going to talk about some other items regarding the pandemic, as well as some listener questions. But I want to talk to you about, for a second, Sanebox. So let me take a second and discuss something with you. I don't know about you, but what's going on with emails these days? I mean, it's out of control. You get spam, junk, unwanted advertisements. You know what I mean? It is so distracting. And I got to tell you something. It's a huge time waster trying to sift through your emails all day, every day. But I found a great solution for you. It's called Sanebox. And it uses an artificial intelligence monitoring system for your inbox. What happens is that it basically scans all of your inboxes, and every email service works with this, and it separates the most important emails that you want to see from the ones that are just, I mean, simply time wasters. The emails that you need are in your inbox, and those that you don't are, well, scooted over to the Sane Later inbox. And working with it is really easy. If you know how email folders work, well, you got it. You know how Sanebox works. Find an email in the wrong folder? Well, just move it. Nothing to learn, nothing to install. Sanebox works directly with every single email server or service that has ever been created. So you can get it for free and a $25 credit by visiting sanebox.com/TDI. That's sanebox.com/TDI. The quote is over. We have that all boxed up and put into a history box. And I want to take a look at some of the things that happened around the world, because it's a pretty incredible quarter, all things considered. There's actually some incredible amount of winners and losers. When I say losers, even some of the things that weren't so good did well, but you have to hear about some of the, I would say, disparity in returns between various sectors. So let me kind of go through a few things. Let's start with the differential and returns in equities of the U.S. based on market cap and style, the traditional style box. 9 boxes, top left being large value, going to the right, which the center is blend, and then you have growth. To the bottom, you have small caps. Again, value and growth. Number one position for the quarter, second quarter of 2020, was small cap growth, up 31.5% for the period. Okay, that's impressive. Mid cap growth was number two, up 28%, and large cap growth was number three, up 27.35%. Okay, all good, all growth. When we go over to the left side and we take a look at the 3-month period of returns for value, it goes like this. Small cap value up 19.38%, still respectable. Mid cap growth up 15.73%. Large cap value up 10.6%. The differential between the two is pretty significant. The differential between the value side and the growth side. Growth outperformed dramatically, and we know that because we saw what happened with healthcare and tech. Now, I've been a proponent, and wrong, for a while now on the thought that value would play a much bigger potential, but while that may have happened, but this whole pandemic and the way that we're seeing the things play out in terms of technology and the hunt for high quality asset sheets, along with the fact that we're looking for cash flow, has really yielded a tremendous amount of benefit towards the growth side of the equation. So that's pretty interesting. I mean, we're talking about the difference between large cap growth on the US base and large cap value. 27% year-to-date, 27% on a year-to-date basis. Now, mid-cap had about a 22% differential Mid-cap growth is up 4.4% for the year. Large-cap growth is up 11.38% for the year. Large-cap value down 15%. And when we look at small-cap, small-cap growth is pretty much flat on the year to the end of the quarter. And the value side on that is down 21. So about 22% spread on that. I mean, that's just remarkable. In terms of regions, looking at the world, and looking at on a year-to-date and a three-month basis, U.S. stocks, and we're talking about the base, like the S&P 500, up 20% for the three-month period, where year-to-date it was down 3.48. Worst is Latin America on a year-to-date basis, down 35%. So a big differential there between Latin America and U.S. Emerging markets down 9.78%, Europe down 12.78%, Asia down 6.42%. Global stocks ex-U.S. down 11% when the U.S. is down 3.48%. So again, we're seeing that the quest for safety and all measures when it comes to areas of quality balance sheets, quality companies, quality countries is very clearly playing out this year. On a three-month basis, U.S. stocks, again, I said, was up 20%. Emerging markets up 20% as well. Europe stocks up 16%. Asia Pacific up 16%. So what this tells us is that the depths of the problem, for example, in Latin America stocks, was much worse and the recovery much less during that period. To still have Latin America down 35% when it was up 18% for the quarter, that's pretty substantial. So they took a much bigger hit during that period of time. Now, looking a little bit further and getting a little bit deeper into this, we can see things like for the three-month period, consumer cyclicals up 27%, financials up 8.7%, materials up 24%, real estate up 10%. Now, on a year-to-date basis, consumer cyclicals are up 2.5%, financials still down 23%. Materials down 7%, real estate down 8.5%. And, you know, we can go over the list. One of the worst hit areas has been energy, but had a great quarter, up 33%, still down 34% for the year. Industrials up 15%, down 14% for the year. The technology area clearly has done well. Technology up 27% for the three-month period, up a whopping 15%. Year to date. So when we compare and contrast the idea of technology companies doing really well, up 14% year to date, compared to energy down 34%, financials down 23%, and the fact that the weight of the S&P within the S&P 500 for technology shares is approaching right at 24%. No wonder why the large cap weighting has really pulled up the rest. Because energy is only a 2.8% position in the S&P 500. Healthcare, which has also had a decent year, only down 0.83%, is the second highest weighting of the S&P 500 at 14.8%. Now, financials are also up there at 13.3%, having a bad year. That's what's pulling some of this down. But that 24% weighting that has happened due to the fact that over the years, technology has continued to outperform and it stays within the S&P 500. Market caps, I mean, trillion-dollar companies says it all, right? For the technology sector, and therefore has really done a great job of pulling things up. And why you're seeing this a little bit of a dislocation in terms of the returns of underlying stocks within the areas of the S&P 500 or large caps, small caps, and the technology shares and the market cap weighted indices that are so highly, such a great level of concentration and weighting, and that is causing this differential. And that's why you're seeing, if you look at the equal weight index of the S&P 500, trailing about 3 or 4%, not terrible, but about a 3 or 4% trail in returns compared to the S&P, which is a market cap weighted. So kind of interesting statistics, something to just think about, something that we're watching and seeing if this is going to continue because, I mean, really, is the S&P right now very representative of the 500 stocks that are underlying the portfolio with its weighting between technology and healthcare being close to about 40%? Kind of interesting if you look at that. And now is there something that would have to be done like what happened over the last number of years with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which changed from a purely industrial average with really no tech in it, over the years added a good amount of technology inside of that to keep up with the times. And is, in fact, there a question as to whether the S&P has to rebalance and change some of their components to be a little bit more representative of the market itself? As long as this goes on, there's going to be the need to overweight technology, healthcare, and to a degree, financials. Because managers that are benchmarked to the S&P 500 are not going to want to be too far off from the weightings of the underlying sectors within the S&P 500, and therefore, it's a perpetual process that's going to stay in motion. So I don't know if there's going to be a change by the powers that be at the S&P 500, but there should be something done, in my opinion, to be, again, more representative of a benchmark that people are utilizing for all their investing. I mean, we use the Russell 1000, 3000, the MSCI Global World Index, Equity Index, as a benchmark that we feel is a better representation for our clients. The S&P is just something to look at, kind of like the Dow Jones is something to look at. All right, we got that. Let's put that aside over here. Let's move along. So I'll tell you a couple things that also happened this week I thought was interesting. I had a lot of conversations, as I do every week, with a variety of people, whether it's clients or analysts or colleagues. Listen to conference calls, listen to presentations, read a lot of materials. And this still seems to be a very significant conversation surrounding the area of valuations. That seems to be coming up very regularly. And I think that last week probably was the biggest topic of conversation as well, from both individuals and colleagues. So I'm not sure right now if I have a good answer or not. Aside from the realization at this point that, well, we have low interest rates and we have a massive amount of stimulus that is in the system. And a lot of people are believing that we are getting further to the end, further to the other side of the question, even though we're all blinded by, or blindfolded. It's not like we're blind, we're blindfolded. Because we don't know what companies are looking to report for their earnings moving forward. I mean, companies have basically pulled guidance. We know that. We've talked about that 1,000 times. So without that knowledge and understanding, analysts are just poking around in the dark. Poking around in the dark. And with that in mind, you have to wonder, is all as well as it seems to be? I mean, case count in the U.S., we talked about this at the top. I'm just going to finish this thought that just came to me again. But case count in the U.S. is up just about everywhere. Some states are hitting records and hospitalizations are seeing a significant uptick. And I still question how consumers are going to react to all of this. When we see a record case count in Florida over the weekend again on a daily basis, and concern from Texas about their hospitalization, ICU beds, and, you know, all the things that you're reading about. You can't not read about it. It's at the top of every news item that you see. But how are investors squaring what's going on with the potential for more closed downs like we're seeing in Australia, where they're locking down a town of 200,000 people, or how we're seeing that some of the phased-in rollbacks, reopenings are rolling back, and how certain areas are going back to, in Nashville, a stay-at-home order. How are consumers going to deal with that about going out? Now, you may say, well, consumers are going to consume, which they are. They'll just go through different processes. That's why Amazon is at an all-time high. Well, Jeff Bezos is back to his pre-divorce all-time high total net worth of about $171 billion. And I was thinking about this the other day. I was driving and I said to myself, I'm thinking, you know, how is this all going to really end? How are we going to stop all this madness? How are we going to see an end to this pandemic? I mean, if it's as contagious as everybody says it is, and seemingly it is, how are we going to slow the spread? Because what happens if, in theory, the entire world goes into a lockdown right now and all the cases that are currently pending go through their cycle? Okay, let's get to the other side. Let's kind of, for a moment, just visualize that. And then say, okay, we're at the other side of that. All right, now what? Now we start reopening again. We still have some cases percolating, of course. People that are asymptomatic don't know if they have it or not. Testing, really, people only going if they maybe are just being extra cautious or if they're thinking that they are symptomatic. And then reopening again, people going out and doing their business, and the whole thing to spark up again. I mean, it seems to me that until either everybody, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, so just, you know, don't shoot me for this, but it seems to me, simple mathematics at play here. Either we gather herd immunity by pretty much everybody getting, or at least being exposed to this, or a vaccine, because otherwise it's just not going to end. So I think that's kind of where we're at. I think that's the reality of the situation. That doesn't mean necessarily we all close up and everything goes to hell in a handbasket. No, I mean, this, again, everybody is going to have the opportunity to adapt through the process, and that's what we're doing. We're all doing this. We're all affected, impacted some way or another. But it seems to me that unless we get a very significant amount of spread of this, which is maybe what is going on, and just get the antibodies and kind of move beyond this, then it's going to be a long haul. All right, so with that, what else do we know? What else have we been talking about? So this week I was a guest on a couple of shows. Hopefully you listened to it. The Barron Report podcast topic was about commercial real estate. And we talked about the outlook specifically for the metropolitan areas around the country and how businesses in those areas are going to fare and how they're going to come out of this whole thing. Because if, in fact, there is a lot of hashtag WFH, work from home, if that is a thing that is really going to pick up speed, then a lot of the metropolitan areas are going to have a problem. Because if people aren't going to work and not going to those big buildings and, you know, they're not going to work in businesses, then the area around them that is supported by those businesses, i.e. the restaurants, laundromats, pharmacies, etc., if the area is not necessarily very heavily populated by residents, but nonetheless with a lot of the walk-by traffic being all about the lunch hour and dinner and all the business being done throughout that area from people that work there, not live there, that could be a big chunk in certain areas around the country. And how are those buildings going to do well if, in fact, a lot of places say, you know what, we're not renewing our lease, we're not paying as much, we don't need as much space. Hey, the buildings that are there right now are not going to be fully occupied. We need to talk about this. And what does that mean to the rest of the area as that bulges out economically? So we talked about that on the Barron Report. You could probably look that up on YouTube. And I was talking about the commercial real estate markets. I also had the opportunity to speak with Frank Curzio this week on his show, Wall Street Unplugged. It's a podcast that has been going on pretty much just as long as the Disciplined Investor podcast. And we talked about some stocks that could really fare well with all of this and the potential for the economy and looking out for the foreseeable future on what is probably going to be the outlook for many companies and the economy moving forward. So I want you to take a listen to those. Frank Curzio, the Wall Street Unplugged podcast, and the Barron Report, which just look up either of those, you'll see a link. Or I did tweet these on Twitter. You can follow me at my handle, which is Andrew Horowitz, which is one word on Twitter. And just scroll through my recent tweets and you will find all of that information that I tweeted and direct links to all of that. So check that out. Now, we have a little bit of an abbreviated show today due to the holiday and the shortened week. I mean, I could take a little time as well, but I did have some questions that came in. You could always go over to Ask Andrew over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button, and there's a couple of different ways that you could ask questions, whether you want to send it in by email, which is fine, or we have that new call-in line, and that number is there as well over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the Ask Andrew area. Just click on the button. All that information will be right there. So the first question today comes in from Todd Zuccarelli, and he says, a long-term listener from back in 2008. Love your show. Todd, thank you for sticking around through all of this, and I really appreciate you listening. That's great. He says, or asks, what is the probability that trading companies like E-Trade and Questrade, et cetera, that are not attached to a bank are blown up by investors using options or futures? What questions should I be asking my institution to properly evaluate this? That's a great question because there's already been some weird stuff. Remember back just a couple of months ago, we had the futures on WTI crude go negative, which was unheard of until that moment. So I think what you should be asking your particular institutions of just ask them simply that, you know, what safeguards do you have that you will not be taken under by a rogue futures trade or some options trade? Now, a lot of them will talk about margin requirements and automatic buy-ins or buyouts or sellouts under certain circumstances. And that could cost them. There have been brokers that were burnt pretty badly. I think there was a story about Interactive Brokers, who we use and who we like, that had like $190 million loss. Now, that's absorbable. I mean, it's a lot, but it's absorbable by companies. They have certain amounts of money set aside for losses like that. You could ask about that as well. But I think that you want to look at maybe what level of futures or options are part of their business. I mean, I think the companies like TD Ameritrade, for that matter, and maybe Schwab, for example, maybe Fidelity, have less than certain other companies that specialize in futures. So, and options for that matter. So, you know, ask the question about what's the set aside, what are the risks, what is their exposure to that, what's their nominal exposure, what's their real exposure, to see what's happening. There is some insurance, SIPC, that guards against certain levels of wrongdoing by the broker themselves. But still, you should probably read also some of the, if you do a Google search on what are the risks to my securities within a brokerage account, something like that, you'll find that if you own the security itself, they're just safekeeping that security. And depending on what the security is, of course, is what is at risk. You know, if they go bankrupt, if it's held in house and it may be in your name, you may still have the opportunity to move the security out of that if they have some financial failure, which is not great because it could be other problems and ripple effects. And I'm not an expert in this area at all. That's something that you probably have to find an SEC attorney or an investment, specializing in investment banks. But just ask a lot of questions and find out what their split is and how much work they do in those areas. I think that would be probably helpful. So thanks for your question. This question comes in from Scott Justinowitz. And he says, I have ERI holdings. What does the merger with CZR, which is Caesars, and ERA merged, mean for me? In general, what terms does a merger mean for shareholders? Basically, with a merger, any merger, this is just a generic question or a generic answer to the question, is that you get one of the companies, usually the stock comes out, that you'll own one of the companies and they pay the other company and you'll own the remaining and probably get some cash kickback from that as well. So this already happened. Basically, now you own both in one company. And usually management of one of the companies will merge into the other. Some people in the management will take over. Usually one company, the strong company that is acquiring, oftentimes will have their management stay and the other management will either be bought out or take a lesser role along with it. But it's all now depending on if you still like the stock itself and whether or not the acquirer and the acquiree can actually have a good synergy together and they are still hitting all the numbers that you want them to hit in terms of profitability, etc. Let's see here. This question comes in from Nevin Svidas. He says, let's see. Hi, Andrew. My question is about the treatment of fixed income when determining optimal asset allocation. I have been testing monthly returns on equities, gold, and government bonds over the last 5 years. I think we had this question or a question similar to this on one of our Monday discussions. We do at 4:30 in the afternoon on Mondays, that pop-up webinar that we do, the Q&A webinar on Mondays at 4:30. He said, my model is telling me that the optimal allocation, highest Sharpe ratio, is 60% equities, 40% gold, and 0% bonds. In other words, return on government bonds is just not worth the risk and more anymore, including bonds in your portfolio results in suboptimal risk returns. I believe that this is due to easy monetary policy across the world and zero and negative interest rates. Given that the Fed announced interest rates are going to zero and stay there for some years to come, do you think that going forward, fixed income as an asset class will play a different or a less important role in determining optimal asset allocations? So obviously, it all depends on the time frame that you're looking at. You did a five-year period and you optimized for that period. You know, if you think about it, if you shorten that up even further, you can get different results. I mean, I think that there is a place for the idea of fixed income as an asset class that will help to buffer to a degree. To a degree, the potential for returns in the area of against equities. But I would encourage you to look at things like commodities, which have not done well lately, and alternative asset classes, and potentially real estate. I would put a lot more into your model than just looking at saying, okay, well, if I substitute gold for fixed income, it looks so much better, which I find a little hard-pressed to believe, actually, and I do believe you. But due to the fact that while gold has been doing very well, bonds have been doing pretty well and have buffered some of the downside due to the fact that interest rates have been coming down. Especially if you go on a 10-year basis and look at it, interest rates have been going lower over that period. So I think one of the problems is the five-year basis. If you extend out the time frame and add some other sectors and asset classes that have diversification potential, I think you'll have a much different result. So tweak those and let me know how those come out. I think you're going to see a much bigger difference in that. All right, with that, we're going to end it. Like I said, listen to the Barron Report. Go over to Twitter and find out where I put those links up. Definitely listen to Wall Street Unplugged with Frank Curzio this week. And we're going to end the show. I wish you a wonderful 4th of July weekend. Do the best what you can to stay safe. Find out where those fireworks are playing. Maybe you'll have to watch them virtually, I guess. Zoom fireworks, I guess, is what's going to be happening here. Crazy. And I'll see you again next week. Thanks so much. discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.